the sea. There was absolutely nothing to do, no phone, no television, no movies. And as the days stretched on, we began to notice a strange sensation. At first I thought it was just the humid ocean air, but then we realized it wasn't the air that had taken on a dimension of depth. It was the time. The time seemed to have thickened and deepened, and our feelings for each other, buried for so long under so much activity and stress, began to emerge full throttle. We felt as if all the nothing, the sudden absence of activity, phones, TV, all this nothing had healed us. We had stopped. We had plunged into nothingness, and we had been re-ensouled. On Rosh Hashanah, the gates between heaven and earth are opened, and things that were beyond us suddenly become possible. The deepest questions of our heart begin to find answers. Our deepest fear, that gaping emptiness up ahead of us and back behind us as well, suddenly becomes our ally. Heaven begins to help us. I was sitting in my living room alone one Saturday afternoon when I heard the sound of a basketball bouncing on the sidewalk outside. Before I knew it, big, wet tears started rolling down my cheeks. The sound of the ball took me back to when I used to shoot hoops with my father, now dead 14 years. We played on the little asphalt court he built for me down the hill from our house. I was an American kid. I lived for sports. I was captain of my high school football team, and I had all the moves in basketball. I could dribble behind my back. I could shoot the J. But my father was born in Poland to a family of war refugees, and when he came to America at the age of 9, he spent every afternoon of his young life working to help support his family. So my father couldn't shoot the J. My father didn't have any moves. My father would fling the ball wildly toward the basket like a shot putter gone berserk. When he tried to dribble, the ball would go bounding off in every direction. Now, you should know that my father had an ego as big as all New York. He never admitted he was wrong, and he competed fiercely at everything he did. He defended his position in the silliest argument as if his life depended on it. Yet he regularly humiliated himself by coming down to this asphalt court to shoot baskets with me, laughing at his own ineptitude, cackling with self-deprecation as the ball flew out of his hands as if it had a will of its own. I never realized it then, but it seems obvious now that he only came down to be with me, his real live American kid, whom he must have loved as desperately as I love my own children today. And as I sat in the living room that Shabbat, I realized something else I hadn't realized before. My father was about as beautiful as it is possible for a human being to be down there on that basketball court. It was the only time I ever knew him to be comfortable saying, "This is me. With all my limitations, with all the loss and suffering my life has dealt me, this is exactly who I am." Sitting there in the living room, I could see that radiant, open, laughing face of his, a face transformed by self-forgiveness. That was when the tears came. Self-forgiveness is the essential act of the high holiday season. That's why we need heaven. That's why we need God. We can forgive others on our own, but we turn to God, Rabbi Elie Spitz reminds us, because we cannot forgive ourselves. We need to feel judged and accepted by a power who transcends our limited years and who embodies our highest values. When we wish to wipe the slate clean to finalize self-forgiveness, we need heaven, a sense of something or someone larger and beyond ourself. Though self-forgiveness may end with God, it begins with us. Self-forgiveness is difficult largely because we hold ourselves to such high standards, higher than it is possible to live up to. And it is precisely when we are hardest on ourselves that we are most tempted to bury our misdeeds, to hide from reality, to deny weakness, to deny that we've done anything wrong. The relentlessness of the high holidays, the long days in synagogue, the constant repetition of the prayers, the fasting, wears down our defenses and helps us open to the truth of our lives. The aspect of the High Holidays that is most helpful in this regard is their holiness. The sense of the sacred is attenuated in the modern world, to say the least. Still, these are, and have never stopped being, the High Holy Days, the days of awe, the days that convey a quality of holiness we can all feel, even if we feel it only dimly. It is precisely this holiness that helps us forgive ourselves. These days create a context of holiness, and if we pay close attention, we begin to notice that everything in our lives is suffused with holiness, even those faults we thought we had to forgive ourselves for. Even that behavior we took to be wrongful, we now realize, has a holy spark at its center waiting to be released. This is the essence of self-forgiveness. Rabbi and contemporary mystic Lawrence Kushner writes, "We may go down into ourselves with a flashlight looking for the evil we have intended or done, not to excise it as some alien growth, but rather to discover the holy spark within it. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonia taught, the essence of the finest teshuvah, the return to one's source in heaven, is that deliberate sins are transformed into merits. So it was that the Baal Shem Tov interpreted the verse from Proverbs, turn aside from evil and do good, to mean turn evil into good. Inner healing requires self-acceptance. Rebbe Nachman of Bratslav offered the following strategy. When all we see and feel is negativity, we must search within ourselves for an aspect of goodness, what he called a white dot within the black, and then find another and another until these dots form musical notes. Our task, he said, is to find enough white notes to form a melody that will define our core and affirm our fundamental goodness. The Talmud tells us that in the world to come, everyone will be called to account for all the desires they might have fulfilled in this world but chose not to. The things we desire, the desires themselves, are sacred. Who put them in our hearts if not God? But we have been taught to be ashamed of what we want. Our desires become horribly distorted and cause us to do terribly hurtful things. Even a betrayal as painful as adultery might turn out to have its roots in a perfectly innocent desire, in the desire to be loved, to have our experience be intense and exciting. And if we could acknowledge these innocent desires, we might not feel compelled to act them out in such hurtful ways. The same is true of the desire for fame and success. We are conditioned to think that it is wrong to want these things, to be too ambitious, and the truth is we do often end up injuring both ourselves and others in pursuit of these desires. But underneath them may be the perfectly legitimate, even laudable need to use our God-given abilities to the utmost. The same God who gave us these abilities also gave us the desire to use them to their fullest capacity. Our desires are neither base nor sinful in and of themselves. They are implanted in us by God to carry us along in our lives, to propel us down the path we need to follow. And if we could accept them as such, we probably wouldn't need to stab our best friend in the back or sleep with our wife's best friend. Ray, our family cat, was a stray who showed up at our house on the weekend of Parshat Re'ech, thus his name. Eventually, we adopted him, and he is still with us some 15 years later. My daughters, ages 6 and 5 at the time, were ecstatic. My wife was not. She was worried that the cat would eat the current family pets, a pair of guinea pigs named Benny and Bert. Her concern seemed irrational to me, paranoid. Why would the cat want to eat the guinea pigs, I wanted to know. It seemed to me it would be the farthest thing from his mind. Because that's the way cats are, Cheryl replied. They're predators. And in that moment I was struck to the root with the realization of what a miracle it is that everything on this planet, animal, vegetable, and mineral, is made a particular way. We are also made a particular way. Okay, maybe it is not in our nature to attack guinea pigs, but the way we are is sacred nevertheless. To forgive ourselves, we must be willing to give up our ideas about how we might be better. We need to give up one of our most cherished beliefs, that there is something wrong with us, that we are bad, inadequate, somehow defective, and lacking in goodness. Disciplining ourselves, rejecting ourselves, beating ourselves, leads us farther away from this goodness, not closer to it. If I have an idea about how I should be, more compassionate, for example, and I go through a process of rejecting myself every time I don't meet this standard, I will never find that compassion, the Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg writes. One kind of emotional process cannot possibly produce another kind of emotional process. Rejection will not lead to compassion. Only compassion can lead to compassion. Rejection will only lead to rejection. But what would happen if every time we did something we disapproved of, we opened our heart to heaven? What would happen if every time we felt an impulse we didn't like, we acknowledged its divine origin? This may be the only change we really need to undertake. The Talmud originally taught that when we pray and do teshuvah and tzedakah, charity, during the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we actually succeed in having the divine decree against us torn up, ma'akarin et hagzerah. The terrible things we did are as if they never happened, and their consequences won't happen either. But do prayer, teshuvah, and tzedakah actually change our fate? The rabbis who came along later realized that of course they do not. The real change is in the way we perceive the world. So they changed the language of the prayer accordingly. Now we say teshuvah, tzedakah, and tefillah, ma'avirin et ro'at ha'gzerah. The act of teshuvah is no longer seen as ripping up the evil decree. Now it transforms the evil of the decree. Teshuvah doesn't change what happens, and it doesn't change the way we are. It merely changes the way we see these things. We no longer see things as evil. We simply see them as they are, and that makes all the difference. Think about the thing you hate about yourself the most. Is it that you're too fat, too weak, too mean? Do you go around talking compulsively behind other people's backs? Do you lie to people? Are you terrible at sports? What would happen if instead of running away from these perceived weaknesses, you took ownership of them? What if you allowed yourself to inhabit them completely, to crawl inside these traits and fill them up with your being? Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that it's all right to keep being mean to people. I am saying that if you keep beating yourself up for being mean, your meanness is just going to keep striking back, getting stronger and more vicious with each blow. If, on the other hand, you were to fill up your meanness with attention and presence, it might just begin to cool down. Like everything else in the world, it will finally have its moment, and after that it will fall away, and you won't have to act on it anymore. The Sabbath is a time when we inhabit ourselves this way. This may be the real reason so few Christians or Jews observe the Sabbath anymore. Work, commerce, and our usual frantic rush of activities are all devices we use to distract ourselves from ourselves, to keep from looking at who we are, to keep us from fully inhabiting our lives. Perhaps the real reason more of us don't observe a Sabbath is not because it's inconvenient, not because we are spiritually lazy, but rather because we are afraid. We are afraid of reflection because we are afraid of ourselves. We are afraid that if we ever stopped running long enough to catch a glimpse of ourselves, we would see something we didn't like. A few years ago, I knew a family who had a teenage boy who was out of control. There was terrible conflict in the family all the time, regular screaming matches, near physical violence. The boy started running away, and eventually his parents saw they had no control over him whatsoever. Now he was out all night. He stopped attending school. They took him to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist told them that they were the problem. They didn't know how to enforce consistent discipline, to apply consistent limits, The boy was constantly testing their limits, and they were constantly failing these tests, the psychiatrist told them. In fact, many people told them this, people at school, friends, acquaintances, people they hardly knew. It had become their mantra, the club of guilt with which they beat themselves black and blue every day. We don't know how to enforce consistent discipline. We don't know how to set consistent limits. So they kept trying to do this, and each attempt was more futile and more disastrous than the last. Each attempt at setting limits, at enforcing discipline, led to uglier confrontations and reinforced the parents' sense of failure. Then the psychiatrist began to suggest that these parents were in over their heads, that they were really not up to being the parents their son needed. He advised them to send the boy away to one of these wilderness camps where rebellious children are taught self-esteem and self-reliance by being exposed to harsh discipline, hard labor, and Spartan living conditions. When they told him their son would never agree to go to such a place, he told them that these camps provided escorts who would come to your house and pick up your child and accompany him to the camp in restraints, if necessary. But they couldn't bring themselves to do this to their boy. It just wasn't in them. This, of course, only made them feel even worse about themselves. The psychologist at the boy's school also felt they weren't up to the task. He advised them to go to court and have their son declared an emancipated minor, thus placing him on the doorstep of the legal system. This they weren't even tempted to try. So, finally, because they had absolutely no alternative whatsoever, they started to look at the reality of their lives a lot more clearly than they had been. The first thing they noticed was that they had absolutely no problem disciplining their other two children when it was necessary, and their other two children were doing fine. Discipline wasn't their problem, they now realized. Their problem was that this boy had a different constitutional makeup. Discipline works very well for some kids, but others internalize it as a devastating and corrosive form of criticism that eats away at their self-esteem. Apparently, their son was such a child. So, suddenly, his parents were able to stop beating up on themselves. They even began to find white spots within the darkness, holy sparks in their son's troubled soul. Their son was a strong-willed, independent young man, full of curiosity about the world and absolutely unwilling to accept the world on other people's terms. What was so bad about that? Several of these traits, they now realized, came from them. It had taken no small amount of courage for them to follow their own instincts regarding their son and to reject the advice they had been given. Maybe they were not so inadequate as parents after all. Now they dropped all attempts to discipline their son. They tried only to affirm him. He was now out all night, almost every night, and out of school completely. It was difficult to find anything to affirm, but they persevered. They resisted every impulse to criticize him. They even developed a little ritual. As soon as their son left the house, they would turn to each other and say all the angry things they had wanted to say to him, but had wisely restrained themselves from saying. The reason you don't feel well is because you've been out all night for the past 3 days, the husband would shout at his wife. The reason we don't have the food you want here is because you haven't spent enough time at home lately for anyone to have the slightest idea what you want, the wife would shout right back at her husband. Several months passed, difficult, agonizing months. They sometimes wondered if they were being criminally irresponsible and neglectful, but they stayed the course. Then the boy worked his way back to school, not his old school, but a new school, one he chose. The anger and near violence that had characterized their family life for so long evaporated. The boy began to express affection for his parents. And the last time I spoke to them, the mother was ecstatic. The boy had eaten her food, had actually sat at the family table, and dined with his parents for the first time in 2 years. The real work we have to do at this time of year, I think, is to find compassion no matter what. But we have to find it for ourselves before we can be of much use to others. The real work is to look at who we really are and to contemplate who made us that way. This, I can promise you, neither you nor your children conform to the ideas other people are trying to foist on you. You are the unique creations of God, and any attempt to pin you down to some idea will only diminish you. You are equal to your life. You have been given exactly what you need, not one thing more and not one thing less. When we experience ourselves exactly as we are, we sense our oneness with everything, and we realize there is no such thing as a mistake. When we pay attention, everything enlightens us, even the things we think of as our mistakes. Everything in life comes to us as a teacher, even the sound of a basketball outside our window on Shabbat. There is an old Cherokee proverb, "Pay attention, learn quickly," or as the rabbis used to say, "Who is wise? The person who learns from everyone and everything." There is a wonderful midrash in the Talmud about a wicked king named Menashe, who lived a full life of evil and cruelty, and then made sincere, heartfelt repentance on his deathbed. The angels of heaven, who knew that God would forgive Menashe as soon as God heard his repentance, were outraged at the injustice of it all, and they tried to lock the gates of heaven to block out Menashe's words. But God drilled a hole under the throne of glory, heard Menashe's confession, and forgave him immediately. Then God turned to the angels. "Look," God said, "it's my business to forgive. This is what I do. This is who I am." Forgiveness, the desire of God to forgive us, is an irresistible force. It fills every space like the waters of a flood. It is one of the most powerful forces on earth, nothing less than the need of the world to be what it is, the need of the universe to have us be what we are. That's why we were created, to be the way we are and not some other way. It is precisely the way we are that is sacred in the first place. And it is the nature of God to forgive. This God tells the angels in heaven, and this God tells Moses firsthand in that famous passage from the Torah that is embedded in the High Holiday Liturgy. "Show me what you are like," Moses pleads with God. And God complies, "My name is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. I am gracious and compassionate. I am forgiveness itself." This is the very meaning of my name, God is saying, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the verb to be in the present tense. I am absolute presence, that aspect of the universe that accepts and forgives. It is your life's work to turn evil into good. It is your life's work to find the white dots buried within the blackness and the melody these dots make. This is the melody you were born to dance to. This is the background music for the real life you are living. Listen to it. What was wrong with my father, for example, was that he couldn't play basketball. He was a poor working stiff, an immigrant without the American graces. And while this may not have been a sin of the magnitude of meanness or infidelity, it was a weakness, and my father did not forgive himself for weaknesses easily. But what was right with him was that he loved his son so much that he managed not to care about this one. He was even willing to forgive himself for his son's sake, and that is the most difficult thing a person can do. It's impossible, in fact, without the help of heaven. I can see him now, in the throes of self-forgiveness, pushing that ball toward the basket, eyes wild and shining, mouth like a fish's, arms akimbo, a foolish grin on his face, dancing with happy abandon between heaven and earth. On Rosh Hashanah, all who have come into the world pass before God. This statement, which we read in the Mishnah, the earliest stratum of the Talmud, is the first thing our tradition has to say about Rosh Hashanah. Indeed, the idea that God is aware of us, that God sees us and is mindful of us, is the very first assumption of this holy day. In its earlier biblical incarnation, Rosh Hashanah was called Yom HaZikaron, the day of remembrance, the day of mindfulness. If God were not aware of us, this whole pageant of teshuvah and forgiveness wouldn't make much sense. Who would there be to return to? How could we ever be forgiven if there weren't an awareness out there that knew precisely what we have done and how we feel about it now? And if Rosh Hashanah did not provide us with the perspective of heaven, with the opportunity to see ourselves with perfect clarity as if from the outside, how would we ever achieve this kind of clarity? How would we ever manage to get far enough outside ourselves to see ourselves accurately? My great-grandfather, Reb Mordechai Shustich, was a very close disciple, a Hasid, of the Rezina Rebbe. He spent the entire year away from home either studying with his Rebbe or traveling all over Eastern Europe teaching Torah and Talmud from tiny town to tiny town, returning home for only a few days every year to visit his wife and children. On those days, his wife, Chana, would invariably beg him to have a picture taken. He was home so seldom, she pleaded. His children could barely remember what he looked like. But Reb Mordechai would always refuse. It was forbidden for a Reziner Hasid to have his picture taken, and that was that. But one year, Chana prevailed. Everyone in our family has a copy of the resulting photograph. Reb Mordechai looks extremely angry in this picture. 1 week later, he dropped dead in one of the small towns to which he had gone to teach. He had fallen asleep at the kitchen table, as usual, with his head in the Talmud. The next morning, when they tried to shake him awake, they discovered he was dead. There are two theories in the family as to the meaning of this event. Some people say, "You see? He never should have had his picture taken." Others say, "Thank God he had his picture taken before it was too late." I seem to have inherited a deep distrust of photography from my great-grandfather. What few pictures there are of our family life have all been taken by my wife. I prefer memory. Memory has a much richer palette. It is more subjective and therefore more reliable. It doesn't pretend to be a mirror of objective truth. When my larger family gathers, we often watch a videotape of my father's last days. It was taken at one of my niece's birthday parties. I hate to watch it. The pale, emaciated ghost of a man who appears in that video is not my father. My memory of my father captures the fullness of who he was much more accurately. Still, there may be more going on here than I realize. We had a videotape made of my daughter Hannah's bat mitzvah, and I hate to watch that one too, but for other reasons. That video forces me to look at myself. I like to think of myself as a mellow, laid-back kind of father, but what I see when I look at myself in this video is a nervous, passive-aggressive fellow with a big, phony smile on his face. So maybe there's another reason I don't like to look at these videos. Maybe I don't want to look at a moment-by-moment unfolding of the way I really am. There is a story about a rabbi who was invited to a congregant's home to view the first showing of the videotape of the wedding he had recently performed for this man's daughter. As the tape begins, the rabbi and the cantor are seen standing alone under the wedding canopy, blissfully unaware that the videotape is running. They can be heard making fun of both families and how poorly they are adapting to their new status as in-laws. Then the cantor makes a disparaging remark about the bride's mother's dress. He calls it a hideous shmata, rag. Then the rabbi himself can be heard uttering a profane assessment of the groom's uncle. The recording of serious misdeeds on tape, either video or audio, has become a commonplace of contemporary culture. We watched the Los Angeles police wailing on Rodney King, and Marion Barry, the mayor of Washington, D.C., buying crack in a cheap motel. It wasn't so common some 30 years ago when White House aide Alexander Butterfield revealed the existence of a taping system in the Nixon Oval Office. The Watergate scandal was at its height, and for liberal Americans, this was the fulfillment of a deep fantasy. The whole world saw this president as he really was, and not as he pretended to be. But it was also much more than that. It was the reinforcement of a deeply held intuitive belief that all our actions are being recorded somewhere, that every move we make is being watched by someone. "Your days are like scrolls," Rabbi Bakia Ibn Bakuda wrote. "Write on them only what you would like to have remembered." And at the very end of the Torah, we find these ringing words, Lend an ear, O heaven, and I will speak. Listen, earth, to the words of my mouth. The universe is watching us, the Torah suggests. The universe is witnessing what we do, and all of it is recorded. It is recorded on earth, and it is recorded in the heavens as well. This is also the suggestion of the great rabbinic legend that forms the cornerstone of our Rosh Hashanah observances, the story of Rabbi Crespude and his three books, the Book of Death for the Holy Evil, the Book of Life for the Holy Righteous, and a third book for everyone in between. The image of the three books calls us to look at our lives as if every deed, every word, were being strictly recorded. If we really understood this, how differently might we have behaved? The rabbi and the cantor wouldn't have made their cutting wisecracks. The cops wouldn't have beaten up Rodney King. Marion Barry wouldn't have smoked crack. And Richard Nixon would have behaved like a mensch. We keep trying to pose for the snapshot of our life. But at Rosh Hashanah, our deepest need is to see the tape. And there really is such a tape. In fact, there is a whole set of tapes. There is the Book of the World. There is the Book of the Body, the Book of Life, and the Book of the Heart. So let's roll the videotape. First, let's look at the Book of the World. Our collective unconscious is scrawled all over the world around us like graffiti. Look at the world. Here in San Francisco, look downtown at the glittering new skyline, the beautiful museums in Yerba Buena Gardens, the new ballpark at China Basin, the newly restored City Hall, literally made of gold, a dream palace where people now stage fantasy weddings, and all of it surrounded by spanking new high-rise apartments and fancy hotels. Look at the street my synagogue is on. Every house on this street sells for $1 million. $1 million apiece. What does this book tell us? It tells us that we are extremely wealthy, even the most ordinary among us. This may very well be the high point of human history, in terms of the number of people who have managed to accumulate significant wealth, or even in terms of the wealth enjoyed by people close to the middle of our economic culture. The stock market goes up, the stock market goes down, but regardless, most of us drive cars that are more luxurious than the houses our grandparents lived in. But let's look at this tape a little more closely. Let's look at the streets underneath these magnificent hotels. There are people sleeping there. There are children sleeping there, more and more every night. Thousands of children sleeping on the streets of the city amid the wealth and the glitter. Even when the stock market is down, we are incredibly wealthy as a nation. But as wealth increases exponentially in this society, so do poverty and homelessness, both in terms of numbers and in terms of the kinds of people who are afflicted by them. Now we have the working poor. People with full-time jobs who can't support their families. Fully one-third of the workforce is in this category now. And we have suburban poor, and most heartbreaking of all, poor children, a growing legion of them. Housing costs are skyrocketing all over the country, but we have cut the safety net to shreds. We've cut welfare to the bone. We've cut the few meager housing subsidies we used to provide. We have made the balanced budget into an idol, a god that must be worshipped at all costs, the Moloch to whom we sacrifice our young. Rabbi Elliot Dorf, one of the leading contemporary scholars of Jewish law, has written that while a balanced budget is a perfectly legitimate social goal, it is totally irrelevant where social welfare is concerned, at least according to Jewish law. By Jewish law, the only thing that may be considered when helping the poor is the need of the poor. We are not allowed to say, we will not care for the poor because the budget won't be balanced if we do. Judaism came into a primitive world where the poor were demonized. Poverty was seen as the consequence of a moral fault. The poor didn't deserve to be helped. But Judaism came to say that this is not how heaven sees things. Heaven thinks that the poor are to be helped, not blamed. But the primitive impulse to blame the poor for their plight persists. Just look at the evidence of the videotape. Look out at the streets. The homeless, in particular, have been singled out for this kind of demonization. They are all drug addicts, the thinking goes. They're all mentally ill, so let's just get rid of them. Let's just run them out of town. It's true. You can look at the tape. There are a lot of drug addicts. There are a lot of mentally ill out there. We've been closing public drug treatment and mental health clinics for years. But let's look at the tape a little more carefully. Let's look at who is really out there. The fastest growing group out on the streets is children, and the truth is that families, working families, are increasingly finding themselves having to choose between paying rent and putting food on the table. The working poor can no longer afford both. This is what we see when we take a close look at the videotape, at the book of the world. We see greed and gluttony, and we see neglect, and we see a growing army of innocent sufferers, whose cries fall on deaf ears down here, but are heard and recorded in heaven. Let's roll another tape. Let's look at the book of the body. I once knew a prosperous and successful architect who had raised a family in a beautiful home in a comfortable suburb of San Francisco. But when his two children became teenagers, they got involved with drugs. His son and his daughter were both, in fact, seriously addicted to drugs. At first, he was furious with them. How could they ruin his perfect life this way, especially after all he had done for them, after all he had given them? But then he got involved with their rehab, with family therapy, and so on. One day, in the middle of a therapy session, his daughter got up and started screaming at him. "You've never been there for us," she said, "not for 1 minute." "What are you talking about?" he said. "I've provided you with everything you could have possibly wanted. I gave you clothing. I gave you a beautiful home. I sent you to the best schools." "But you never gave us yourself," his daughter said. "Not once. Not for 1 minute." This man was struck to the core of his being by what his daughter said because he knew immediately that it was absolutely true. So, being a fairly scrupulous and thorough person, he set about trying to discover why it was he had withheld himself from his children so thoroughly that they had both grown up seeking love from the end of a hypodermic needle. He went into therapy, and that didn't work. He did encounter groups, and that didn't work either. Then he started working with a Reichian therapist, someone who worked directly with the body. And this person focused with him on a particular knot of musculature in his back for many months. And one day, he just felt this muscle letting go, unclenching for the first time in his memory. The very next moment, he felt a mind-numbing fear, a total, all-embracing, paralyzing fear. The moment after that, he had the strangest sensation. He certainly felt this fear. He had rarely been so certain of any feeling in his life, but he was equally certain that he wasn't afraid of anything. He was surrounded by fear, but he wasn't afraid. Finally, he realized what he was feeling. The fear that had surrounded him, that had paralyzed him, that had stood between him and everyone he had ever attempted to love, was his mother's fear. He wasn't afraid, but his mother was. His mother had been an extremely anxious woman, and when he was a child, he had assimilated her fear. He had taken it into his own body, and this fear had been lodged there ever since. It had been a constant barrier. It had affected every relationship he had ever had. It had caused him to withhold love, to keep himself apart from the people he cared about, to distance himself from everyone and everything in 1,000 unconscious ways. Now he could see it. Now he could read the book of the body. The truth of our lives is the closest thing to us there is, as the Torah reminds us. It is right in front of our eyes. It is embedded in our bodies. There are several volumes entitled The Book of Life on our shelf, but we want to be sure we pull down the one that will be useful to us. Reading the book of our successes, the book of the way we have presented ourselves to the world, the book of the prizes, the family car, the six-figure income, the trophy spouse, this book will tell us nothing we don't already know. After all, we wrote this book. This is the book we spent our life energy writing so that people would think highly of us, which is to say, so that they would fear us and envy us. This isn't the book we need to read. This isn't the tape we need to watch. We need to watch the tape that has painstakingly recorded everything, including our failures, our dysfunctions, and our heartbreak. We have to look at this tape long enough to see the recurring patterns. What keeps coming back? What circumstances keep repeating themselves in our lives? Why do we keep losing jobs? Why do we keep losing husbands? Why do we keep getting into the same kinds of conflicts with people wherever we go? Our families record our real lives with an unflinching precision. This is a tape that never stops rolling. We may look lovely in that snapshot, that picture of kindliness and good cheer we present to the world at large, but when we come home and take out our frustrations on our wives and children, the tape is still running. Our behavior is stored forever in our children's hearts. A good question to ask ourselves as we plunge into the process of Teshuvah on Rosh Hashanah is this. What would we read about ourselves if our children wrote a book about who we were? How does our family see us? What would the tape reveal when our guard was down? And we can be sure of this, too. All those peripheral moments, those moments we thought no one would notice, they'll be on the tape, too. The tape didn't stop running in between the events we imagined were important. It caught all those small in-between moments, too. The moments when we thought no one was watching. It counts, even if we felt invisible when we were doing it. And every once in a while, that motorist to whom we have just given the finger or that woman whom we have just ogled catches our eye and we freeze. We see ourselves in their gaze, our rage and our lust. We probably don't like what we see in those moments, but they have a kind of power nevertheless. They remind us that we are being watched. We can see ourselves in the eyes of these strangers. And the tape is rolling when we deal with people we feel are invisible, witnesses, toll booth collectors, indigent strangers who ask us for handouts on the street. Our interactions with people whom we might be tempted to regard as unimportant tell a great deal about who we are. At my synagogue, I am often shocked to discover that people who always speak to me with unfailing consideration and the utmost respect regularly berate the synagogue secretaries mercilessly when they call for appointments or for better seating arrangements for the high holidays. I think they must imagine that since I am God's agent on earth, God only pays attention to their interactions with me and doesn't register their conversations with the secretaries. Why, after all, would God be interested in unimportant people like my secretaries? But the annoying thing about God is that God seems to be interested in everyone. It's on the tape. It's written in the book of our life. And after the book of the world and the book of the body, the truth of our life is also written in the book of the heart. We can feel it there, pressing up against our rib cage. It is perfectly self-evident. All we have to do is read it. If we just stop and quiet ourselves, our broken hearts announce themselves. We know our disappointment very well. We know our shame and our failure. During the days of awe, we pound our heart repeatedly as we recite the Vidui, the confessional prayer that is repeated over and over again in the High Holiday Liturgy. We point at the heart. We pound at the heart until it opens, and we can read it. Why does it take such an effort? Largely, I think, because we don't feel safe about exposing our hearts. We are used to being on the defensive, to having people use our heartbreak and failure against us. This is one of the reasons the 12-step programs have become one of the most successful American spiritual movements. They provide people with a safe place to read the book of their own heartbreak. And they begin by acknowledging that they can't read it, they can't see it, without the help of heaven. An event that taught me a great deal about how we Americans feel about heartbreak was a PBS series that ran in the 70s called An American Family. This was perhaps the first conspicuous example of public exposure by videotape. This show documented the life of the Loud family of Santa Barbara, California. It focused an unforgiving lens on every moment in the life of this family for a period of 7 months, and during that time the family completely fell apart. It was a classic illustration of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that the act of observation changes what is being observed. Later, people asked the Louds why they had permitted this devastating intrusion on their private lives. They said they were proud of their family. They had a great marriage. They were successful. They had a beautiful house, and it was full of attractive kids. They thought it would be great to show themselves to the world. But as they lived their lives under the camera's unflinching gaze, the family became conscious of themselves, and they didn't particularly like what they saw. The camera exposed a life of deceit, adultery, cruelty, drug abuse, and homosexuality, which back then was still regarded as a matter of shame. The husband was a terrible philanderer, as it happened. The daughter was addicted to speed. The older son was a homosexual who came out of the closet as the series was being filmed. Before the show was over, the Louds were divorced, and at least one of their children had run away from home. And how did America receive all this? The Louds became an object of disdain and derision. People wrote letters to their newspapers and called in to talk shows. "What a terrible family," they said. "Why are we looking at their lives? What does this have to do with us?" They continued to watch, of course, but despising the Louds became a national pastime. I will never forget the moment Pat Loud, the mother of the family, finally got it. It happened somewhere around the 7th or 8th episode. She finally saw her family. She saw her life as it really was on this video that never stopped running, this book of her real life, and it completely broke her heart. Her husband was unfaithful. Her children were in terrible trouble. The photograph, for which she had so carefully posed, was crumbling to dust, and her heart was breaking. The minute it finally did, I fell hopelessly in love with her. All the way from the other side of the TV screen, I was smitten. That's how I always feel when I see someone in the full reality of their suffering, when I see them with their hearts broken open. I've never seen a human being in that condition who wasn't exquisitely beautiful. I was amazed to discover that most people didn't see her that way. Most people thought she was a dope. But I am sure that God did not. God also fell in love with Pat Loud. Of that I am quite certain. This is what God always does when God reads the book of the heart. This is how God is different from Big Brother, who also knows everything we do and say, but who uses it against us. God watches the whole video with a boundless, heartbreaking compassion. This is the God of the classical Midrash. In any case, a God who watches us stumble and blunder through this world, weeping profusely as he does. So it is with the destruction of the great temple of Jerusalem. God watches the whole tape. The people of Israel sinning egregiously, the people of Israel engaging in gratuitous hatred, first the Babylonians and then the Romans marching on Jerusalem, and then the temple finally falling. And when it does, God weeps. And God wept at the death of Moses. Talk about heartbreak. Let's roll the videotape of Moses' life. When we think of Moses, we tend to see Charlton Heston, the great lawgiver, the greatest of all the prophets, the deliverer of his people. But Rabbi David Wolpe offers the following synopsis of Moses' actual life. The first time we see Moses as an adult, he walks out of his father's palace and murders a man. Then he runs away, marries a Midianite, and lives in exile among strangers. God selects Moses for the great mission of delivering his people, but what does Moses say? "No, thank you, I don't speak well. No one will believe me," and so on. But God says, "Look, you have no choice in the matter. I'll give you good allies, your brother, your sister, and the people Israel." So Moses sets out on his mission with all these allies, and one by one they betray him. His sister Miriam betrays him. She slanders him for marrying an Ethiopian, and he has to pray to God to save her life. Then his brother Aaron betrays him. When Moses is up in heaven receiving the Torah, the greatest moment of his life, Aaron is helping the children of Israel build the golden calf. And the people betray him too. In fact, they betray him right and left. This seems to be what they do for a living in the wilderness. They betray Moses. They refuse to go into the land when they are supposed to. They rebel against him and accuse him of arrogating power to himself. They complain incessantly about the food and the water. Finally, God and Moses are alone together, just the two of them coursing through the desert. When they come to the edge of the promised land, what does God say? God says, "You die here." Why? "Because I once told you to speak to a rock, and you hit it instead." Big deal. Forget all the Midrash. Moses was a leader. He was held to a higher standard of responsibility, yada, yada, yada. Just look at the tape. He was a human being. He made a little mistake. Is that any reason to deprive him of the fruition of a lifetime mission that he had never asked for in the first place? Finally, we see Moses begging for his life, pitifully calling upon heaven and earth and the Torah to intercede on his behalf for one more hour, one more day. And what does God do then? God listens. God says, "Moses, you are a human being, and all human beings have to die, and now is your time. But I'll attend to you. I'll bury you myself. I'll give you my full attention." And then God comes down and takes Moses' soul with a kiss, weeping, weeping, weeping as he does. God saw Moses' bare, broken heart, and God fell in love with Moses the same way I fell in love with Pat Loud. At Rosh Hashanah, we begin to acknowledge the truth of our lives. This truth is written wherever we look. It is written on the streets of our city. It is written in our bodies. It is written in our lives and in our hearts. We have a deep need to know this truth. Our lives quite literally depend on it. But we can't seem to get outside ourselves long enough to see it. And besides, we are terrified of the truth. But this is a needless terror. What is there is already so. It's on the tape. Owning up to it doesn't make it worse. Not being open about it doesn't make it go away. And we know we can stand the truth. It is already here, and we are already enduring it. And the tape is rolling. The hand is writing. Someone is watching us endure it, waiting to heal us the moment we awake and watch along. From the great pit of our heart, we sense the seeing eye, we sense the knowing ear, watching the drama of our lives unfold, watching with unbearable compassion. Chapter 7. What the Soul Does While the Gates Are Still Open, the 10 days of Teshuvah. For 10 days the gates are open and the world is fluid. We are finally awake, if only in fits and starts, if only to toss and turn. For 10 days, transformation is within our grasp. For 10 days, we can imagine ourselves not as fixed and immutable beings, but rather as a limitless field upon which qualities and impulses rise up and fall away again, like waves on the sea. Some of these impulses rise up with particular intensity. We may even experience them as afflictions. But they can be the keys to our transformation. Their intensity points to the disequilibrium and dysfunction in us that is in need of transformation. For 10 days, the field of mind is like a painting by Kandinsky. Energy and form float in that field. And we have the sense that we can shape our lives by choosing where to invest our focus and intention, by choosing which forms to follow and which to let go. This is not a linear process, not something that takes a clear nor even discernible path. Rather, it happens in fits and starts. Sometimes it may not even seem to be happening at all. But the gates are in fact open, and if our intention is aligned with this spiritual reality, then transformation also opens as a real possibility, even if it doesn't manifest itself right away. Parshat Netzavim is the beginning of the grand coda of the Torah. It is usually read the week before Rosh Hashanah, and since no new readings are introduced until after the holiday, Netzavim hangs over the 10 days of Teshuvah like a ghostly presence. This is fortunate, as it happens, because Parshat Netzavim addresses Teshuvah itself, the process of active transformation we experience during the 10 days, more directly and to greater effect than any other portion of the Torah. And it shall come to pass when all these things have come upon you, the blessings and the curses that I have set before you. And they will rise up again, Hashev Ota, in your heart, among the nations to whom the Lord your God has driven you. And you will return, Veshavta, to the Lord your God and listen to God's voice. Then the Lord your God will turn, Veshav, your captivity, and have compassion on you, and turn, Veshav, and gather you in from all the nations where you have been scattered. And God will circumcise the foreskin of your heart, so that you can love God with all your heart and with all your soul. And you will turn, Teshuv, and you will hear the voice of God, and do all the commandments which I have commanded you this day. And God will turn, Yashuv, and rejoice over you again for the good, the way God rejoiced over your ancestors. If you turn, Tashuv, to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1 through 10. The most apparent aspect of this passage is that the word shuv, to turn, to return, to repent, the root of the word teshuvah, is repeated 7 times. As we have noted, this sort of ritual repetition signifies that the word is extremely significant. Here it illuminates several important facets of the process of teshuvah. First of all, we learn that teshuvah can arise in the most hopeless circumstances. In fact, it often seems to begin that way. This passage begins in the darkest days of exile, when we are sitting among the nations to whom the Lord your God has driven you. Most of us only embark on the difficult and wrenching path of transformation when we feel we have no choice but to do so, when we feel as if our backs are to the wall, when the circumstances of our lives have pushed us to the point of a significant leave-taking, when we have suffered loss or death, divorce or unemployment. Transformation is just too hard for us to volunteer for. Interestingly, God is depicted as the one who is doing the pushing here. We are in the predicament that has brought us to the point of transformation because God has driven us there. In other words, that predicament is part of the process. It is a gift, the agent of our turning. Second, this passage shows us the complexity of transformation. Transformation is not something that happens once and for all time. The people turn 3 different times in this passage, and as it closes, they are promised a great blessing, but only if they continue to turn in the future. Transformation does not have a beginning, a middle, or an end. We never reach the end of Teshuvah. It is always going on. We are awake for a moment, and then we are asleep again. Teshuvah seems to proceed in a circular motion. Every step away is also a step toward home. And it may never be clear to us that the work of transformation has borne fruit. This is usually the case in the realm of spiritual practice. Real spiritual transformation invariably takes a long time to manifest itself in our lives. Spectacular, immediate results, sudden changes in aspect or in the way we see the world, are always suspect and usually suggest a superficial rather than a profound transformation. Profound transformation only manifests itself over time. When Jacob has his great vision of the ladder and realizes he has been visited by God, he exclaims out loud, "My God! God has been in this place all along, and I never knew it." From this moment of epiphany, we expect he will be changed. We are disappointed when he continues to behave like the same manipulative schmo he has always been. But when we look at the larger arc of Jacob's life, we see that this vision really does effect a profound change in him. It's just that this change isn't evident right away. It takes more than 20 years for it to take root. My old